1 Peter chapter 2, we're going to be looking at verses 11 and 12 there for tonight. I kind of had a little difficulty trying to figure out a title. I'm not too thrilled with it, but I couldn't come up with anything. Anyway, so it's called The Fight Is On. Actually, there was a hymn. Anybody remember an old hymn called The Fight Is On? Anybody remember that? It's an old one, anyway. But you can see this. It mentions, I think, a conflict here. In 1 Peter chapter 2, 11 and 12, it starts off with, "Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation." There's another occasion, and it's not the only one, but Paul writes to Timothy and charges him to fight the good fight of faith in 1 Timothy 6 and the first part of verse 12. And he also discusses, and we're probably very familiar with this, he discusses piece by piece the full armor of God in Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 through 17. Now the armor that's described there, he takes the picture of a Roman soldier in doing this. And that's not dress armor. It's battle armor. But now he does qualify that the battle that we're in is a spiritual battle. Paul does. And that you see in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Now we're going to read that. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3 through 6. 2 Corinthians 10, 3 through 6. "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled." Now you look at that, and yeah, I think most of the time, brethren reason accurately that this means we're not to engage in a physical combat, and that's true, and that's not what it's talking about in the Scriptures when it talks about war and the battle armor and fighting a good fight and other things along that line. That's not what it's talking about. I'm not talking about physical combat. But now what happens is we go the other way to an extreme on this sometimes, and there's far too many who determine that there's no combat to engage in at all. Well, again, that's going too far. As a matter of fact, it gets to the point when they're arguing about this that essentially we don't have any weapons. But in 2 Corinthians, it says the weapons of our warfare are this. So I wonder when having weapons as Christians is denied, what are we then, powerless? And I think to myself, excuse me, it does say war, doesn't it? Did you notice there in our reading back in 1 Peter chapter 2? Let's go back there just for a second. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and in verse 11, there are things which war against the soul. Now, are we just supposed to just give up? And no defense, nothing. We just surrender right off the bat. And just I can't see that kind of thing, and I think that you understand. But it's war against the soul, and that shows that, yes, it is indeed a spiritual matter and a spiritual battle. So our study tonight focuses on that fight, that kind of fight, the spiritual fight. And so there's three things I'd like for us to consider in the sermon here. And number one is that there are challenges in these two passages in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. And one of the challenges, and we've said this several times in this series of sermons, one of the challenges is to recognize the standing. Now, let's recognize the standing of a Christian. We are temporary residents. And we look at that a number of times in verse 1, the pilgrims of the dispersion, and in 12, in verse 11, as sojourners and pilgrims, there in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 11. But then also, and there's other places where we can find this kind of terminology, but in Hebrews chapter 11, I thought this was a pretty good one in verse 13. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 13. That these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off. Remember now, these are Old Testament characters that are being described here. They saw them afar off. They were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed, watch now, that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. If we would think about it, we would think about some of these Old Testament characters. And a lot of them, you know, well, they, what's the terminology used today? They marched to a different drummer. You know, they realized that they were different. Wherever they were found, they were different. And there were different things that were expected of them. You think about a number. You think about Joseph, and you think about Abraham, and some of the well-known characters in the Old Testament. And, you know, that fits them. And I also think that we need to remind ourselves that there was a period of time when Joseph became this prominent figure in Egypt, and all of his family and Jacob, brothers and everybody, a good sized number, they all come up to Egypt. They all move up there. That was quite an undertaking. And they remained there. And they prospered there, to where they became, finally, when you get over to the book of Exodus, a sizable number of people that, the Egyptian ruler felt like needed to be reckoned with. You know, there were just so many of them. And they eventually became a slave labor force in Egypt. But that all the while this was going on, Egypt wasn't their home. And eventually what happens? Well, they're led out of Egypt, as it says, you know, by a mighty hand. And they get over into what we call today Arabia, and they wandered around over there. They didn't really wander around the whole time. They were not home the whole time. They were actually encamped in one place for over 30 years. But 40 years from the time they left until the time that they crossed the Jordan River. And all the time, they were not at home. You know, Canaan, the land of Canaan, was their home, not Egypt. So I think to ourselves, you know, we're kind of like Israel in Egypt. We're here, we live here, we work here, we're around people, you know, and so on. But we're kind of strangers here. We're temporary residents is always the wording that I like to use, and like Israel was when they were dwelling in Egypt. And as we've pointed out a couple of other times, and we've pointed out again, and I think it's important, you know, this whole idea of being these temporary residents is kind of a prominent thing in Peter. And I really think that it's prominent in here because everything else works off of that. And it's to get the recipients of this letter to understand that this is not our home, and we might try to abide as much as we can by the things here. We really answer to a higher power than anything else that there might be here. Philippians chapter 3. Let's look over there. In Philippians chapter 3, verses 20 and 21. Now, we've looked at these before, where it says, our citizenship is in heaven. from which we also eagerly wait for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body, that it may be conformed to His glorious body, according to the working by which He is able even to subdue all things to Himself. Our citizenship is in heaven. Jesus will come, transform us into something different, something that's made for eternity, and that's when we'll go home. But we're not home here. And one thing to remember is, heaven isn't coming here. We're going there. And I think sometimes there are actually religious doctrines that get that confused. They think heaven's going to come here, of all things. They think heaven's coming here and it's going to be over in Israel. And that's where Christ will be sitting on the throne. He's sitting on the throne now, and we're going to go to heaven where Jesus is. And He's the one that's going to transport us there. Ephesians chapter 2 is another place I'd like for you to look at. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 19, where it says, "Therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God." That's where our allegiance is at. That's where our loyalty is. And that's where it should remain. So there's a challenge here to understand this difference. And this is a difference that makes a difference. And it's something that's important. And if we don't look at it this way, then we miss a great number of things that we'll find not only in the book of 1 Peter, but elsewhere. Now, the second thing I'd like for us to consider is the conflict. Now, let me hasten to point out that this conflict is not something new. No, not at all. It wasn't even new in the first century when the New Testament was written. And another thing, neither is it necessarily worse now than ever, although I think we're in the habit sometimes of saying that. Good versus evil has been around since the garden. People might think immediately of Cain and Abel, and you'd think right. But really, with the temptation before that in the garden, wasn't that a case of good versus evil as well? Now, it's been around that long. And you might think of it as, well, it's God versus Satan. All right. Or you might think it's flesh versus spirit. Sometimes it's explained that way. And sometimes it's Christians versus the world. And that's the sense that you have here in 1 Peter 2, verses 11 and 12. Let's think about the weaponry of the enemy. Now, let me hasten also to point out that it talks about there, if you go back to 1 Peter chapter 2 for just a second, you'll see in verse 11, "Abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul." Now, we're told in James that there's temptation. And a person is led away when they're enticed with their lust. So, temptation is the vehicle or the avenue through which lust works on us and our desires and so on. The minute it clicks with us, that's really something I'd like to do or be involved in or whatever it is, and make a choice on this. The minute we make a choice to go with it, well, then we've surrendered to the temptation. And that's when we enter into sin. But the weaponry of the enemy, I think one place where you can find a lot of them mentioned is in Galatians chapter 5. And you may realize where this is going. In Galatians chapter 5, we're going to take a look at the works of the flesh. In verses 19 through 21... Now, there might be a little difference. Some translations don't have the first one, adultery, mentioned there. That's a technical point. Some manuscripts don't have it. Some do. And some translators decide to leave it out. Some include it. Fine, you know, I always think, well, whatever. If you don't have it, certainly fornication covers adultery as well. But what you have here when you break them down, I'm not going to read them all now. We'll look at them here. When you break them all down, the first things that are mentioned there are sexual sins. Fornication, impurity, sensuality, or lasciviousness. And then the second grouping are disloyalty. Well, idolatry, sorcery, or some translations will have witchcraft. But that's disloyal. Disloyalty to God is what it is. And the third one, which is by far the biggest one category of all of them, is it deals with emotions. Our emotional side, we've got one. And such things as enmity and strife and jealousy, outbursts of anger, where do they come from? Do they come from our emotional nature? And what about other things? Disputes and dissensions and factions or heresies and envyings, where do those come from? Do they come from our emotional nature? Yes, they do. And these are the things that are used as fleshly lusts against us. And we're tempted to do something. We're tempted to be jealous, or we're tempted to have lose control of our anger. You know, someone always will say, "Well, I just lost control." Well, that's accurate. You know, if there's an outburst of anger, yeah, you lost control. Nobody's going to argue with that. But now you realize that's not okay. That's something that's wrong. But there's so many things that are up here. And then you get down to the last two, and there are these social things that unfortunately are approved of today. Such things as drunkenness and carousing, partying, you know, that sort of thing. And then there are a few other things. If they're not in this listing, you can find other things. Just for example, like in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, 9, and 10. There are some more over there, some of which are duplicates of what's here, but then there are some other things. So you can look through several of these and you find out, boy, there's a whole lot of them. That these things that war against, the weapons that are being used against us. So many things. But by and large, the answer to this isn't quite as hard as we would think that it is. But let's just think of one more thing. One more thing. If we add something to this that I think we have to consider, and it fits in here so well, in 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 3 and 4, we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles. You see what he's saying here? It's time to get over this now. And some of us have. You know, some of us just said, enough. Enough. Not doing it anymore. And then what? Well, he's saying, when we walk in lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, abominable idolatries, we walked in these things. The idea is, you know, we were really involved in these things. We there was a part of us that just lived for this kind of stuff. And don't tell me that that doesn't happen. Yeah, it does happen. But then verse 4, in regard to these, now the things in verse 3, in regard to these, they, who are the they? Well, your former companions in these things, they think it strange that you do not run with them anymore in the same flood of dissipation. And what do? They speak evil of you. Here it is now. You've done something good. You've done the right thing. And you've quit all of this business. You said enough. I'll not do it anymore. And yet there are people that realize, oh, you once did this kind of thing. And they're going to give you the business. They're going to speak evil of you. Oh, well, you know. He may say it's wrong to go to these drinking parties, but, you know, he used to go himself. Well, no argument there, but the thing is, I don't go anymore. I quit, and here's why. That sort of thing, you see. So what is this? Well, it's kind of peer pressure. A lot of people would knuckle under to that, but it certainly is ridicule. So get ready for that. That's some more of what's being used in this war against the soul. But now, I want to hasten to point out here, there are some defensive weapons that are here. And without going through a whole list of them, I just want to point out, you know, just a few here. And the first one is self-control. It's listed in the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians chapter 5, verse 23. And how about over there in what's ordinarily called the Christian graces? It's self-control, or the old translation has temperance. You remember back years and years ago, there was a lady by the name of Carrie Nation. Remember? And she's noted for having the hatchet. And her cohorts, they'd call a raid on a saloon someplace. Probably needed to. This wasn't a bar like something up the road up here. I mean, these places were just, boy, they were just unbelievably, you know, hives of wickedness. But they would go in there and take, and they would destroy everything in there. She'd take the hatchet and she'd chop up the barrels that had the booze in them. They'd all run out on the ground. You know what they called themselves, the people that belonged to that movement? They called themselves the Temperance League. And they were calling for temperance, self-control. I thought to myself a time or two, it'd be nice if they'd have practiced a little bit themselves, you know. Running around with axes and hatchets and things makes you wonder. But you understand what their motive was. Self-control. There wasn't any self-control. Temperance. That's what that means. And that's how it's used in newer translations. So, who's got control of yourself? You do. Primarily, you do. That's right. We all do. We understand that. We have this self-control from infancy on up. Self-control. Now, we'll have different measures of it. Sometimes we'll employ it. Sometimes we will not. But to say that we don't have any, or it's absent, or born without it, or anything like that, is absolute nonsense. We do. We also have the sword of the Spirit, which in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 17, you know, to take the sword of the Spirit, and then it says, which is the Word of God. So we've got that. We've got that as a defensive weapon. And what does that do? Well, it gives us instructions. Turn to Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2. And we'll take a look at, we'll just look at verse 12 here. Titus chapter 2 and verse 12. Teaching us that, or some translations have, instructing us that. Denying ungodliness, and what is that? Look there, worldly lusts. We can deny the. You mean we can actually say no? Determine not to. Yes. And what else does it say? We should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age. Now, King James Version has world there instead of age, but you get the idea. And back there where it says soberly, that doesn't mean to live sober is in the sense of not drinking or not drunken. Soberly means to live in your right mind, is what the word means there. Like to think soberly. But the instructions that we have are part of the defensive weapons. And so, you know, we ought to become familiar with these things so that we can be successful. So I would say, just based on what you see there, now it is true, you know, we think about the weapons of the enemy. Kind of an impressive number of things, but we've got adequate defense here. We're not powerless. And we ought to use the things and not just give up. But we ought to fight the good fight of faith. Romans chapter 6 and verse 16. A minute ago I said that we have self-control. We can make the right choice. And it's pointed out to us here in Romans chapter 6, verse 16, that we can make the right choice or we can make the wrong choice. But we have freedom of choice, self-control. Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness? So we're going to make a choice, one way or the other. And that's got a lot to do with self-control. If we're exercising self-control, we can make the right choice. And when we don't exercise self-control, we'll make the wrong one. Now, the third point I'd like for us to consider is conquest. Back in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11, it uses the word abstain. And I don't know how many thought of that. Every time I see that word abstain, I think of 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 22. Abstain from, as King James says, abstain from the appearance of evil. And I know the translators did not mean how some people take that word. Some people take that word. Here's what our brethren do. We take that passage, abstain from the appearance of evil, and we add a word to it. Very. Abstain from the very appearance of evil. And so then that's applied this way. Well, we can't do anything that might look wrong. And can you think of anything more foolish than that? What exactly is there that out here in the world and everything that wouldn't look wrong to somebody? Look at that. I've got a wristwatch on. Do you know that back in the early part of the 20th century, a man wearing a wristwatch was considered to be effeminate? Did you know that? In other words, if you had a wristwatch on, you were a man with a wristwatch on, appeared in public, people would think that was wrong. What do we have today? Well, again, the same wristwatch, even though it's not looked at as feminine apparel or feminine accessory anymore. The Amish think that that's evil. Do I need to throw my wristwatch away because somebody thinks the very appearance is evil? That's not what the passage means, although it's been used that way. I think it's been used that way sometimes to control somebody and to get somebody to not do something that you don't like. But anyway, what it really means, and I think this is the idea, the Holman Christian Standard Bible I thought had the best idea here, best translation, stay away from every kind of evil. It's not the appearance of evil, it's talking about real evil. Every kind of evil. Some translations will have the form of evil. Okay, that's fine. And evil does come in different forms. But whatever form it comes in, it's real. We're not talking about something over here. Well, that's just not my cup of tea, so I'm not... I think that that's evil now, and we just can't... No, that's not what that means at all. But we're supposed to abstain from this. Now also, in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 3... it says about certain things, don't let it be named among you. And it's talking about sins there. Don't let it be named among you. Don't let it be said that these things are going on among you. That these things that are proper among the saints. You're not doing things that are proper among the saints. I think sometimes that there are people in the world that see Christians do things, and the people in the world know that they're wrong, and they're right with their knowledge of this. And that's to our shame. And we think to ourselves, well, it doesn't matter what the people of the world think. Oh, really? It doesn't? I think that it does. We'll see that here in just a moment. Now, also, in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 is another place where we can find a call for this staying away from this idea. In 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 17, there's a call for separation here, where it says, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. Now, I got the question up there. You see what it says. There's a call for separation. How cozy are we allowed to be to things that are sinful? How cozy? Now, there are people, what they decide, well, I know where the line is, and I'll just go as close to that line as I can possibly get. As a matter of fact, you know, it's like I'll go to that line, and then I'll lean over just a little bit. You know. Really? and you think that's wise? Would you do that at the edge of a cliff? Oh, no. You know, one of the things that just scares the wits out of me is to see a group of people, if at least one of my relatives, one of my loved ones, on the edge of something. I don't care if it's a riverbank, a cliff, whatever it is. If they're right there, I just want to grab them and just a screaming madman rush up there and grab them and haul them all back where I think they would be safe. I think it's dangerous. Do we think that sin is dangerous? Do we think it's warring against us? Do we want to get cozy with us? Cozy to it, I mean. In 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 12, there's a call there, and I think we can see this, for honorable conduct. We'll look at it again there. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 12. Having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles. Now, not just honorable among each other, but among the Gentiles. You think about, well, that in and of itself, well, that's a challenge too, isn't it? But you know, this is this business of your conduct. That's that manner of life word. It means your behavior. So let your manner of life or your behavior be honorable among the Gentiles. You know, we're expected to be above reproach. Isn't it Matthew chapter 5 and verse 16? It says, let your light so shine that others will see it. And what will they do? They'll glorify God. And then you get Philippians chapter 2 and verse 15. You be lights that shine in a crooked and perverse generation. That's how we're supposed to be. Well, it seems to me, you know, that that's a call for honorable conduct as well. And really, when we think about this, there might be a lot of things that are said, but they don't carry any weight to them. They can't be proven. And it's where there's an accusation may come along, but the accusation then is found false and foolish. You know, it won't work. I had someone call me one time on the phone in West Virginia with an accusation against one of the elders. They wasn't a member there. They had been at one time. And called up there, and then they started in on this man. I'll tell you, he was a good man. And where it kind of went off the rails, they said, well, you know, he's just one of these guys that just wants to be a dictator. And just wants to tell everybody everything to do, and it's got to be his way or the highway. And just went on and on and on like that. And I listened to all that, and I said, well, I'll keep watching for the... I didn't believe a minute, word of it, for a minute. I said, well, I'll keep watching for that kind of thing. But I said, I've been here almost 4 years, and I haven't seen anything like that yet. I'm going to tell you what, if somebody was like that, you'd see that not... It wouldn't take 4 years. It wouldn't take you 4 hours. See, something like that. But I knew that it was false and just foolish. It won't work. It won't stick. Well, that's how our behavior is supposed to be, you see. Clean. Clean. And so somebody will make an accusation, but it'll just fail. Now take your songbooks, turn to the song that's been selected. Now the devil, through the complicity of the world, is seeking whom he may devour. And the devil calls to leave constraint behind. The devil calls out to plunge in and do your own thing. The devil calls to grab for all the gusto. And think of it as we know this, and we see this. And you know, as a result of that, I think that to call out to abstain is going to seem like a voice that's crying in the wilderness. And yet, we are told in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, that God is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. I'd say that He's a rewarder of those who will diligently abstain from fleshly lusts that war against the soul. William Barclay said in his commentary, and I thought this was really good. I don't like doing this kind of thing, but this was almost too good to let it go. He said, the Christian is not a permanent resident upon the earth. He is on the way to the country which is beyond. He must, therefore, do nothing which would keep him from reaching his ultimate goal. He must never become so entangled in the world that he cannot escape from its grip. He must never so soil himself as to be unfit to enter the presence of the holy God to whom he is going. Pretty good statement. Abstain from fleshly lust. One of the ways to do that is to repent, to turn from darkness and turn to light. And once someone has made the decision to turn, then also to make the decision to have one's sins washed away. And that takes place with baptism. It's twofold. You turn from sin, those sins are washed away. And then what's the end of that? Well, you find forgiveness. The idea of washing is to become clean and acceptable in the sight of God. If we can help someone to do that tonight, we'd be glad to do that. Fallen by the wayside, correction needs to be made, we'd be happy to help you with that. Whatever the case might be, if you're subject to invitation, why don't you come all together, we stand and sing.